events in Detroit have dominated a lot of Michigan news here in October, most noticeably the city's bankruptcy trial. That has not been enough, however, to overshadow the race for mayor and city council. Joining us to review and update that and several other of October's biggest Michigan news stories, Tim Skubick, the host of Off the Record, seen on WKAR-TV and online.
Buenos dias.
Tim, good to see you.
I decided to do the show in Spanish. Is that okay?
No, that's a...
Subtitles?
A wonderful touch. Susan Demas is starting her last day before officially becoming the owner of Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter, and she is back with us. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
And John Lindstrom of Gongwer News, recently returned from 2 weeks in Ireland. Welcome back, John.
And Paris.
And Paris.
Top
of the morning.
Are you doing it in French?
we're trilingual.
That's right, yeah, well...
That is quite a combination, Ireland and France. That is getting both ends of Europe.
And there's a strong historical connection between the two, which I'll let you go get a book and find out.
Oh, okay, very good. We'll Google that here in just a few minutes. Let's look at a bill in the news today at the Capitol that impacts Ingham County in particular. A week or so ago, Senator Rick Jones, the Grand Ledge Republican, introduced a pair of bills that would rework the state's Court of Claims. Now, this is the court that handles legal actions against the state. And the reason this would impact Ingham County so much is that those duties are currently handled by Ingham County Circuit Court judges. We should point out that the bill passed the Senate yesterday, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. But first, John Lindstrom, what is Senator Jones proposing here and why?
Well, in theory, what he's doing is talking about taking the Court of Claims out of the Ingham County Circuit Court, where it has always been since the new Constitution in 1963 was established, and creating a system whereby when you have a case, the Supreme Court would appoint members of the Court of Appeals to handle the actual litigation. And this is a fairly significant change because the Court of Claims handles a lot of stuff. Ingham County Circuit Court judges handle a lot of cases involving financial claims against the state. And this would specifically change that, put it into the Court of Appeals. From one standpoint, it changes the whole appeals process because you would have now one less potential appeal that a case could have. An appeal from the Court of Claims goes first to the Court of Appeals and then theoretically to the Supreme Court. Now it will go from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. But in many respects, the big issue here is that the Democrats are making a charge against, and one can make the argument that they're right, is that the Republicans are very unhappy with the Court of Claims structure as it is right now. Ingham County is a fairly strong Democratic county. A number of the judges in the circuit court system here in Ingham County have Democratic backgrounds. This court has been a key area that of arguments on the right to work situation, on changes to state worker union programs have gone through this court, and so clearly Republicans are unhappy about that. And the fact that this is moving with such blinding speed certainly would indicate that there is a very strong partisan element to what's going on. Things only move this fast if there's a legitimate emergency that the state needs to act on, or if this is a partisan issue.
This helps explain to those of us who have always been a little bit confused why it is Ingham County judges determine so many statewide stories. How was it Judge Rosemary Aquilina was deciding issues affecting the state, or Bill Collette, or the Ingham County Circuit? This is the reason why. And the Court of Appeals is a more conservative body, isn't it?
Well, more Republican, but this ought to be called the James Giddings Memorial Bill, because Giddings is the one who sort of started this whole thing when John Engler was governor, which you guys remember. They had a thing, okay? And the Ingham County Court was always a target because they were making, quote, the wrong decisions as far as Governor Engler was concerned. So I asked Senator Jones, I said, is this politically motivated? And he said, absolutely not.
He says a judge, a staff, health care, et cetera, could cost a county $450,000 a year. So he makes the case that the county is already financially stressed. Its judges are overburdened. The Court of Appeals is just as qualified to take this over as anybody.
Well, at the same time, the legislature is Republican. The governor is Republican. He has faced an awful lot of lawsuits for various matters from the Detroit bankruptcy on down. And let's not forget that last December, Republicans did set a precedent with the right-to-work legislation where baked into that bill was that any litigation bypassed the circuit court level. So you were already a court of appeals. So this already was probably in the works back then.
So I mean, there is some logic. You could make the argument that why should one county's circuit court be the specific judge of all of these financial matters? Why specifically Ingham County as opposed to Wayne County or Kent County, for that matter?
Right.
Why, when the Constitution was set up, was there not a specific separate court set up to deal with financial claims against the state? But the fact that it's being handled in this manner and with this speed raises another point altogether, which Senator Jones says there's no political aspect to it. Well, maybe to Senator Jones there isn't, but to everyone else there is.
Senate Majority Leader Whitmer blasted the passage of the measure yesterday, saying her GOP colleagues are, quote, unnecessarily interfering with judicial oversight and rigging the system, unquote. Is it worth noting that several of these Ingham County judges have contributed to Senator Whitmer's campaigns?
Well, I mean, as the point was already made, a number of these judges have Democratic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And have they contributed to Senator Whitmer? Sure they have. But let's, you know, you go through the history of it. Judges contribute to all kinds of people. You've got a number of, as was pointed out recently, Judge Saad on the Court of Appeals gave, what was it, half of his salary, the equivalent of half of his salary to Republican candidates. Now, his family has his financial means, so, you know, he could afford to do that. But judges contribute to partisan candidates all the time. So that's, in and of itself, nothing new. Again, if this was really something very, very significant that people need to look at, yeah, you'd be taking a little more time than you're taking right now.
Legislatively, what's the prospects for this?
I assume it's a done deal.
Really? Susan?
I would assume so. You've got strong Republican majorities in both houses.
Yeah.
I would say that as a reporter, I'm not sure any politician has ever told me that they've done anything for political reasons. It's always for policy.
Okay. Worth noting. Let's visit where the Detroit bankruptcy trial is right now. We're stuck in the eligibility phase for longer than a lot of people hoped, including, it appears, Judge Stephen Rhodes, from frustration that he vented this week. What is slowing things down?
Well, you got a lot of people involved. Okay, everybody's got to have their day in court, and the guy who had his day in court on Monday was Snyder, wasn't that his name? Very unusual, very historic thing. I was not there for it, but I talked to some, at least one of the reporters who was there, and read, of course, the accounts. And what the attorneys are trying to prove to keep the city, the unions are trying to keep the city out of bankruptcy, and they're alleging that the Snyder administration from the get-go always wanted to send the city into bankruptcy and therefore did not negotiate in good faith. And the law basically says that in order to get into Chapter 9, you've had to go on through the process of at least trying to solve this problem without going into bankruptcy. And so that's really what the nif-gnawing is all about. And it will go on until the judge finally makes a ruling sometime in November, I would guess, and then we'll proceed from there.
Late last week, Free Press reporters Brent Snavely and Nate Bomey wrote, quote, "There didn't appear to be any major surprises that could derail Detroit's eligibility for bankruptcy," unquote. Has anything happened this week to suggest that attorneys representing the unions and pension holders are scoring points?
Well, there was the issue that, you know, Governor Snyder did come out that he could have pursued a bankruptcy option that would have protected those pensions.
Yeah.
So I think that was news this week. I still think that probably the state feels pretty confident about where it's at.
Susan's right. That's the major issue that came out, was that there was an option looked at or potentially could have been looked at and was rejected. And it's hard to say. I mean, it's interesting that Judge Rhodes is getting a little impatient. The reports that he told Kevin Orr,
step on it.
Yes, you know, speed it up. When you're asked a yes or no question, basically answer yes or no and not go into a long flowery response. So,
does a much longer than anticipated trial benefit one side or the other?
I don't think so.
No?
It's hard to say.
Okay. In the meantime, we've got this interesting scenario whereby the Attorney General told the Detroit News, reiterated to the Detroit News yesterday, that it's his job to protect those workers' pensions because they are constitutionally protected in the state.
But it's also his job to present the other side, too, which is he's gotten some flack on that, but that's a long-held role of the Attorney General. In fact, I talked to the former Attorney General, Mr. Kelly, who said the genesis of this, of the AG representing both sides in a case in front of the court, which sounds counterintuitive, basically was the courts said to the Attorney General, we don't trust all the attorneys on the plaintiff and defense side, so why don't you give us both guys or ladies from your office, and then we know we're getting ethical information. So that's where that came from. It goes back a long time.
I don't know anybody who's played both sides since Goldman Sachs. You know, that's you just don't hear about this that often. But what's the takeaway from Governor Snyder's appearance this week, then?
As Tim said, very historic. He was extremely cautious in how he handled himself. How much you could glean from it, I don't know. I think the unions feel like they got a bit of a victory just getting him on the stand. But but how much? How much he contributed to the final product, we don't know at this point.
There was no smoking gun. That's what they were looking for. Look, I read the depo that he did for 3 hours. This was just basically a rehash of that. I had one reporter, Chad Livengood, I wrote him last night. I said, when I read the deposition, there were a lot of attorney-client privilege stuff and a lot of I don't recall. He said it was much more powerful when you saw him on the stand saying that stuff. Mm-hmm. It sort of amounted up to more of an evasive approach, whereas reading it was not quite the same thing. But look, this guy is a very slippery interview, and he's good, and he wasn't going to give them. First of all, he says there's nothing to give them, okay? Mm-hmm. This was a last resort. I didn't want to send Detroit into bankruptcy. And he points to the consent agreement, which was a step before that, which simply didn't work out. The trigger, though, and this is, came out in both the depo and also his testimony, was the unions going into courts to try to wrap all and tie all of this stuff up for the next 3,000 years. That really pulled the trigger. They decided we better move, and we better move quickly on this in order to make sure we get this filing done.
That was the ballot measure.
No, not the ballot measure, filing. The filing by Mr. Orr had the letter queued up and teed up and ready to go to file for bankruptcy.
Oh, okay.
The governor says, hey, these guys are in court trying to stop us. Let's go. Am I reading that correctly, guys?
Yeah. There was discussion about when they were going to need to file, and they knew that the unions were going to try to do something. So it was just a matter of who moved first and when.
And this legal drama is playing out alongside the conclusion of an election campaign for mayor and city council in Detroit. In the mayor's race, Mike Duggan, well-established Wayne County guy, Detroit Medical Center executive, and County Sheriff Benny Napoleon are the mayoral candidates. Will Mike Duggan become the first white mayor of Detroit in 40 years or so, Susan?
Short of him confessing to a string of serial killings, I would say yes.
Yeah. What else do you take away from the mayoral campaign in Detroit alongside all of the bankruptcy drama?
Well, the interesting thing is Mr. Duggan has said, I will cooperate with Mr. Orr, and Mr. Napoleon says, I will not. And I believe that while there is a vocal minority in Detroit which is dead set against this bankruptcy, I think there is internal polling data that suggests the bulk of the people in Detroit are saying, as witnessed by their supporting of Mr. Duggan in the primary, we want to change. We want something different. Mm-hmm. And I think they're willing to go along with
and,
that.
And Mike Duggan, they have something different.
They do.
Uh-huh. Well, it's historic for a write-in candidate to be able to score a 20-point victory in the primary. And, you know, the race was all but over at that point because it doesn't really look like the sheriff ever put up much of a fight after that point. Mm-hmm. The polls have stayed remarkably consistent.
What do you make of it?
There seems to be an older element that is absolutely opposed to the idea of Mike Duggan and anybody cooperating with the bankruptcy and everything else going in, and another element that's just at a point, we need to get something done, we need to get something fixed, and so let's move ahead with that. And one point that hasn't been made a whole lot, it's not having to do with the mayoral election, but the council election, is, you know, now we're going to get council members who are elected from districts, which is going to be very, very significant, because for decades, everyone was elected at large, and you pretty much had a city council that reflected only a couple of areas in the city. So this could be a very significant thing. Once the city gets back into essentially self-governance, will you now start to see greater efforts being made in other neighborhoods because people now have actual representation in on the council?
I'm really curious about that. Would you expect a more cohesive city council to emerge from this?
I mean,
the previous city council had a notorious reputation for dysfunction.
Right. I would expect that you're going to see a situation much like you would in the legislature or any other place. You're going to see coalitions build. You're going to see people try to make alliances on various things because there are some areas of the city that have struggled far more than others.
But let's not lose sight of the fact that they aren't in control.
Well, that's right.
No, that's true. I mean, for the time being, what I'm saying is when they finally do get back under self-control.
What does it mean in the meantime? What will new faces matter as long as there's an emergency manager in the city?
Well, I think that John is right to bring up the neighborhoods issue because that's more of a parochial thing for them to concentrate on, and that's been a huge theme with the city council elections, which have not gotten much attention, but that's where the mail pieces are at. That's what people are campaigning on. I want to take care of this neighborhood in Detroit, not just downtown. So I would see that perhaps with having these representatives from certain areas of the city, they'll start to work on issues specific to their constituents.
It's Current State's Month in Review for October. I'm joined by Tim Skubick and Susan Demas and John Lindstrom. The NERD Fund, which was the Snyder administration's fund, comprised of anonymous donors whose contributions defrayed the cost of government, went the way of Skunk Works here a few weeks ago. This appears to have been an embarrassing lesson for the Snyder administration.
Lesson learned. The governor said, I didn't know all this stuff would happen if I created a fund and didn't release the names. And the interesting thing about it is senior advisors basically told him as he was pondering the creation of this, Governor, everybody does this, so just don't worry about it. Once the governor lost control of this issue. And I think this could have been taken care of in a much quicker and neater way. It dragged on and dragged on, and it still does to this day. Now they've created a new fund, which will be, they tell us, transparent. Mm-hmm. And I said to the governor, why didn't you do that the first time? And that's when he said, because I was not a career politician. I'd never dealt with this sort of thing. But he had others around him who have, and maybe he didn't get good advice on this one.
So the political education of Rick Snyder continues.
Even as we speak.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for politicians to create these funds. Mark Schauer, his Democratic opponent, had one. I think the difference for Snyder and why he got so much blowback is that he ended up using the fund for people who were deeply involved, like Rich Baird, in creating policy and being part of his government. And that was being done with private funds, and nobody was knowing where it came from, what kinds of conflicts of interest there were. And that's why I think it sparked so much of a backlash.
As Tim pointed out, Mark Schauer, Democratic candidate for governor, quickly acknowledged that he used to have a similar fund years ago. Does that neutralize some political advantage that he might have been able to use
in
the election?
Well, he released the names, was the names of two people that were on the list, and then they said they had lost all the other ones. I don't know where they went.
Okay.
It neutralizes it slightly, but as Susan pointed out, you had the situation of Rich Baird, who was a key administration player, who was working for the public but being paid privately. And what the governor came into this as a business guy, and he tried to do things pretty much as business people do, which is you move quickly, you make a decision, you do this, you don't necessarily always worry about the public relations part of it until afterwards. And in politics, you really have to think about what's the public relations part of it before you go into it. And he did not do that.
Well, his problem was he ran on the issue of transparency. And this was anything but.
Oh yeah, I mean that's what I'm saying. If you're going to say that you're going to have a transparent administration, then you've got to make sure that what you're doing meets that definition of transparency.
Well, and then he had the problem. He said, "I promised these people I wouldn't release their names." Okay. Well, you know what? He could have gone back to them and said, "Look, I would like to release your name. If you give me your permission, I will. And if you don't, we won't."
Do you think that happened?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
It crossed my mind whether or not some of these supporters may self-identify in an effort to try to salvage something from
this
situation.
Just to tie this back into the Detroit bankruptcy case, part of the reason the union attorneys wanted to find out who was on the list to see if there were any favors that were done by Jones Day, the law firm, had they contributed to this fund, and they end up with a huge contract with the city of Detroit. And when the attorneys tried that in court the other day, the judge stepped in and said, out of bounds. Which I thought was kind of interesting, because if you're trying to make the point that there was influence peddling going on, allegedly, how else do you find out than by looking at the fund?
Yeah.
And the judge said, we ain't going there. And the governor must have gone, whew, that was close. Although he said he didn't know any of the people in the fund to begin with.
Which
means he is pretty close to being a career politician. If you think about it.
He's learned quickly. Yeah.
He has learned quickly. I don't want to know who's on the list.
It's interesting to ponder money coming from Jones Day to the Nerd Fund to go back to Kevin Orr so he can fly back and forth to Washington, D.C. That is...
We do. Let's be clear. We don't know.
We don't know that.
We don't know that, but that's what the attorneys wanted to find out.
Well, call me cynical, but can we assume that the transparent group will attract less cash?
That's hard to say. I mean, it may depend on whether or not the governor is reelected. The business community is very, very tied to him, and they're certainly going to support him as strongly as they can. And we'll see. We'll just see what happens once this election is over.
John, the Tea Party and its supporters are being widely blamed for the partial government shutdown that happened this month. How is that playing out more recently here in Michigan between mainstream Republicans and the Tea Party?
Well, in this state, nationally, you're starting to see, however you want to put them, the old guard, the establishment Republicans, basically fighting back to a certain degree. And one of the more vivid examples of this came actually a couple of months ago now, when Senator Howard Walker, who is not running for re-election, was at a function up in Traverse City, and one person who was there criticized him and others for being weak Republicans for supporting Medicaid expansion. And he's there at the microphone, and he says, screw you. And, you know, people were just stunned by that. And that, was sort of, in this state, maybe the most visible example. But you are now starting to see people, starting to fight back. Part of this is because the Tea Party has made Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly their target. Mm-hmm. They want him off. And they're going to make a major effort to try to convince the convention to knock him off and put one of their people on as Lieutenant Governor. In the 2014 election, there's been a lot of talk in the party about how do we finesse around this, try to protect the lieutenant governor, and this fight is now drawing. And now you're starting to see some of the Tea Party people, like Jack Hogendyke, putting up emails and other notices saying they're after us now. We have to step up. We have to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the issue for establishment Republicans who, were buoyed by Tea Party supporters in 2010 and 2012 to some degree, is that now when they want to fight back against what they think it has become a more destructive force, they still face a Republican primary situation where it's a very small cut of the electorate, 20% or less, and usually the rule is the most conservative candidate wins. That can often outdo the money being spent. And it's hard to outflank a Tea Party candidate and be more conservative than them. And so establishment Republicans may have a reckoning in 2014 in some of these primaries.
Quickly, let's go around the horn here. Your most underreported story for October, in your opinions?
I think this has been a very lackluster fall session for the legislature. There are 61 days left in the state of Michigan, and they will be in town a grand total of, count them, 18 days. We got to take care of hunting, and then, of course, there's Thanksgiving, and then there's Hanukkah, and then there's Christmas.
Wow.
So 18 days between now and the end of the year. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that maybe they'll fund transportation. Anybody here believe in Santa Claus? They will have to fund the Medicaid expansion thing, which will be very contentious. So they could get some stuff done, but they aren't there yet.
Okay. Susan?
Well, my favorite unreported story comes from Oklahoma U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, who is not a fan of Michigan's national parks, apparently, and thinks that they are the ultimate symbol of government waste. He doesn't like Isle Royale. He doesn't like a copper mine site up in the UP. He even doesn't like the Sleeping Bear Dunes, which Good Morning America says is the most beautiful place on in America. So I thought that was a little misplaced, and I'm sure he'll face a backlash.
Okay. John, quickly?
Something that's come up recently, so it's only underreported because it's just come up, but a bill in the Senate Energy Committee that would allow phone companies to end landlines. And this has become a very, very significant issue for older members of the state. The Attorney General is worried about it. The PSC has come out against it. AARP has warned legislators that they consider this a significant issue that they'll monitor in terms of things like endorsements.
I can't wait to see whether third graders in Michigan may have to repeat if their reading is not up to speed, too. That just, we learned a lot more about that yesterday. John Lindstrom of Gongwer News, Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter, and Tim Skubick of WKAR-TV's Off the Record. Many thanks to all of you.